tonight's topic, euthanasia and end-of-life issues, I'm not going to treat them separately. I'm going to talk about them kind of together because they fit very well together in terms of course of actions to be taken or not to be taken or that kind of thing. So I'm not going to treat them separately. I was just trying to think of the name of the topic, and that's kind of what I came up with to kind of cover everything we're going to talk about, right? So the first thing we want to talk about is the laws that we see in human nature and in human nature, which we would call, or just the natural order, we call natural law, right? Certain things that we can discern just from the natural order. We don't need God or scripture or anyone else to tell us those kinds of things. The divine law backs up a lot of that, but sometimes when people say something, especially to, you know, Catholic, about, well, where is that in the Bible? Sometimes the response is, it might not be in the Bible, but it doesn't need to be, because it's in the natural order. Anyone who has the use of reason can discern certain things. And so our starting point with this, and just as a kind of a refresher, we talked about that especially on the topic when we did homosexuality, that is found right in the natural order. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to look and notice a certain complementarity between the male body and the female body, that when they come together in a certain way, that they can produce, you know, new life, you know. And so, yes, scripture and the church teaching says something about homosexuality, but in a sense it doesn't need to, because it's already found in the natural law, right? So as Catholics, we use our reason. We're not just, you know, blindly following, you know, some guy in Rome, or blindly following the Bible or whatever. Yes, we respect and we follow the magisterium, the teaching authority of the Church, having been given the authority from Christ himself to interpret authentically the Scriptures, and we follow the Scriptures, but we also follow what we see in nature. We follow the natural order. So as a starting point there, what we see in both the natural order and in the divine law, the natural law and the divine law, in relation to this topic tonight, is really the command to do no harm. And in fact, you've heard of the Hippocratic Oath. You know, when med school students graduate, they traditionally take that Hippocratic Oath, which is millennia old. And that first line of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm. You know, you've heard this before, that this is essential to the medical profession, that before we even talk about what you are going to do, we're going to talk about what you're not going to do. You're not going to do harm. So that's the first kind of overarching principle, first do no harm, right? From there, I wanted to talk about our dignity as human beings, right? Because especially when you hear talks, when you hear people very impassioned talking about euthanasia, they talk about, oh, just let the person die with dignity, as if somehow euthanizing them is going to allow them to die with a greater dignity. And a classic distinction that the Church makes when we talk about dignity is intrinsic dignity versus attributed dignity. So your intrinsic dignity is that dignity that every single human being has simply because we are human beings created in the image and likeness of God. And that can never be deteriorated. It can never be added to either. So the dignity that I have as a human being is the same dignity that, you know, a one-celled zygote has in the womb of its mother. And it's the same dignity that someone who is a quote-unquote vegetable has, you know, who's strapped up to all sorts of tubes and everything else. That intrinsic dignity is the same in any of those situations, right? Because we're all created in the image and likeness of God. We have, you know, we have that that on our soul. We have that in us. So that can never be taken away. We can talk about attributed dignity when we talk about things like the use of reason. Okay, so obviously the one-celled zygote inside of its mother's womb does not yet have the use of reason. But then again, neither does the newborn. And you really don't even get the use of reason until later on. And then you have the use of reason, and then eventually you get old enough and you begin to lose it, right? And that's just one example there. But sometimes people will point to that as, well, that should be our measuring stick. That, well, you know, if you don't have the use of reason, then somehow you've lost your dignity. And then you know, we're going to, you know, then that's okay to kill that person if they don't have the use of reason. And this one standard that people will use sometimes, but you see it kind of becomes a bit of a slippery slope because it's always, well, what about right before that or what about right after that? You know, so that's why when it comes to dignity, we, from a Catholic Christian perspective, we see everyone as having an equal dignity just by virtue of their creation, just by virtue of the fact that they were created in the image and likeness of God. The other thing about being created in the image and likeness of God that's important to remember, and just to set this out, I'm going to go through some of the more theoretical stuff first and then get into the actual practical nitty-gritty details of end-of-life issues and that kind of thing. And but the next thing to keep in mind is, as a principle here, really, is that because we are created in God's image and likeness, from a Catholic perspective, we see ourselves as being stewards and not owners of our life. And that is one of the reasons why the Church teaches against something like euthanasia, because I don't even have say over my own life. Because sometimes even well-meaning, well-intentioned Catholics can say, well, look, I understand, you know, why murder is wrong or why anything else, you know, because that's going after someone else's life. But can I at least determine my own life? And the answer is no, you can't. You didn't have any role to play in your own conception and ensoulment, you know. It was a gift from God, and it always is a gift, and so we are stewards of that gift. We're not owners of it. We can't determine its beginning or its end, right? So that's the next kind of theory thing here. And then when we get into morality, classically we talk about three sources of morality in the Catholic tradition, and those three sources are the action itself, what is being done, the intention of the person doing the action, and then the circumstances surrounding that. And the reason I bring this up, as basic as it sounds, is because in today's society, I think most people, it's safe to say, will accept those last two, the intention and the circumstances, in terms of judging things. Well, what are you trying to do? What's your intention? People get that when you talk about intention. And when you talk about circumstances, people get that too. Well, in this under these conditions or in this particular situation. But then when you talk about the action itself, is the action itself good or evil? Sometimes people get like, well, what do you mean? It's going to do something good. Well, that's not the point. Now, I'm not talking about what it's going to do. I'm not talking about what, you know, circumstances around it. I'm not talking about what your intention is. Again, those are all the other parts of morality, but the action itself, we need all three of those to be good. We need all three of those to be upright for the morality of the action to be upright. And if any three of those, the action, the intention, or the circumstances, can make an action morally evil, can make it inappropriate to do. And let me just give you, let's just go through a few quick examples here. A classic example that's usually given, well, before I give this, let me talk about one other thing and then I'll get into my example. So sometimes these three, when we talk about the thing, the act itself, what you're doing, when we're talking about the intention, what am I trying to do, and then when we talk about the circumstances, sometimes it does get very complicated. In fact, often it gets very complicated. And St. Thomas Aquinas, a great philosopher and theologian, he was a Dominican friar from Italy in the 13th century. He did a lot of philosophy, a lot of theology, and he was really a champion of what we call the doctrine of double effect, which kind of helps clear up some of the confusion when these three things tell us different things. And a classic example here that will kind of clarify what I'm talking about, that's often used in seminary and theology, is the situation of a woman with ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, a pregnant woman with uterine cancer, right? And the reason why this example is used is because you can see all three of these things working out here, because the Church teaches, of course, that any kind of abortion is wrong. Abortion is the direct killing, right? It's the direct killing of an unborn person. And that's the action itself, right? And that's always wrong. It's always wrong to directly kill an unborn person, right? So the action of abortion right there, it doesn't matter what the intention is. Maybe my intention in having the abortion is not to kill the person, not to kill the unborn baby, but maybe my intention is to make sure my parents never find out I had sex before I was married. Or maybe my intention is to be able to graduate with my high school degree and not have to, you know, get behind in my studies. And maybe the circumstances around it are good in the sense that the circumstances are, you know, if I do this now, I won't graduate on time. If I you know, so, but the action itself, that's why we talk about the action being always intrinsically wrong. You know, the direct killing of someone is always wrong. So no matter what your intention is, no matter what your circumstances are, even if your intention and your circumstances are good, that's where the action would kick in and say, okay, well, that's what makes abortion wrong, because what you're doing itself is intrinsically evil. You're directly killing someone, and so it doesn't matter how upright your intention or circumstances are, that's what makes abortion always wrong, right? But then back to this other situation of a pregnant woman with uterine cancer. This is a classic situation, like I said, that's given, because we look at this and we say, okay, well, we know abortion's wrong, so if this woman has uterine cancer and she's pregnant, we can maybe hope that she can last with the cancer until the baby is carried to term and deliver the baby and then get rid of the cancer, either through, if it's not too far, you know, either through some kind of chemotherapy or just, you know, just to remove the whole thing, right? But what happens if you can't do that? What happens if you can't carry the baby to term? What happens if it's a matter of the woman's going to die if we don't remove the uterus, the cancerous uterus, right? And according to the doctrine of double effect, the doctrine of double effect would say, well, my intention here is not to kill the baby. My intention is to cure the woman of the cancer, to get rid of the cancer. And the circumstances here are all upright as well. My intention is not to kill the baby. The doctrine of double effect foresees an unattended side effect. So obviously, if you remove the uterus, the baby is going to die. There is no way in which the baby is going to live despite the removal of the uterus. If you remove the cancerous uterus, the baby is going to die. So I can foresee that. I can know it's going to happen, and yet I don't intend it. I don't want it to happen. My intention is not to get rid of the baby. My intention is simply 100% to get rid of the cancer from the woman. And again, perhaps we've ruled out those other circumstances that, well, maybe she can carry it to term and then have it done. Okay, well, that can't happen. And so this is what we're left with. You know, we have to remove the cancerous uterus, right? The doctrine of double effect says that it would be okay to do that. And yes, the baby is going to die, but the doctrine of double effect says that is an unintended, even though it is foreseen, it's a foreseen yet unintended side effect. And so that's what makes something like the removal of a cancerous uterus okay, despite the fact that the woman's pregnant. Does that make sense? Okay. That's a situation in which the circumstances and the intention there matter. Now, again, the action. So what we couldn't do, for instance, is we couldn't go into the woman, kill the baby, and then remove the uterus, because then what we're doing is an intrinsically evil action. There is an evil action going in there and killing the baby. There's generally nothing evil. There's no intrinsic evil to removing a uterus. But in this case, obviously, you know, if it's cancerous, it has to go, right? So that's the doctrine of double effect. And I would point out, again, those three sources of morality just to think about when we talk about action, when we talk about action, intention, and circumstances. Thank you. Spilled some of my coffee. I haven't even got to drink it yet. And like I always say, these little booklets will explain it much better than I can. On my foot too. Okay, so that's the doctrine of double effect, and those are the three sources of morality. The next thing I wanted to talk about was the various perhaps documents to have when you're preparing your own. When you're preparing for your own demise, just a good thing to have before. In my class at the seminary for medical ethics, part of our requirement to pass the class was we actually had to turn in our own living will. He wanted us to come up with the living will and the healthcare power of attorney. So those, they're generally four documents, and I'm going to talk about these real quick because I'm going to give you as the second handout one of those. That's in like a Catholic form, so it's really cool. So you hear a lot of these different terms, but it's good to know what they are. So you have your durable power of attorney, which does everything but healthcare, right? And then you have your healthcare power of attorney, right, which is able to make decisions and incur costs on your behalf and that kind of thing for you. So you have those two, your durable power of attorney, your healthcare power of attorney. Then you also have your last will and testament, you know, who gets what in the family. Then you have your living will, and that's the one that I'm going to focus on here, because the living will is you saying what you want done in these situations. So your healthcare power of attorney is the one who is supposed to help execute the living will. But one of the things they always kind of pointed out in seminary is that a person is better than a paper, and so it's good to have that living will, but it's even better to have with it, not in its place, but with it, a healthcare power of attorney who can be there and actually help to interpret the circumstances around a particular situation. And this leads into the next point, because one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church's teaching on all of these issues, is sometimes they think that the Catholic Church says, well, like, you always have to do this, or you always have to do that, or you can't do this, or you can't do that. And when it comes to a lot of these end-of-life issues, the church's teaching on this is very patient-specific and not procedure-specific. And that's why, for instance, one of the examples we'll get into in a minute here is it's abbreviated MANA, M-A-N-H, Medically Assisted Nutrition and Hydration, or just A-N-H, Artificial Nutrition and Hydration. So basically like the IV or the PEG tube or that kind of thing that provides the basic water and food. And this especially came to a head, remember, like with Terry Schiavo's situation, and there were a lot of people who thought, from the Catholic perspective too, that like, well, the food and water must always be provided. And there is within our tradition a general preference that, you know, that this should always be done. But the good thing about the Catholic teaching in this regard is that, again, it's patient-specific, not procedure-specific. And so if you have something in your living will, for instance, that says artificial nutrition and hydration must always be provided because you think, well, I'm a strong Catholic and that's what the Church teaches, which is not what the Church teaches, but people think that, and they put that in there and they say artificial nutrition and hydration must always be provided no matter what, and you don't have the healthcare power of attorney to properly interpret that or to help interpret that, that's where it can get dangerous. And one of the things to watch out for, I had a parishioner come to me a few weeks ago who is in fine health now, but basically said, look, I know I'm getting up there in age, and my husband and I want to have these documents kind of in order, ready to go when that time comes, and very responsible thing to do, I thought. And she showed me, she wanted to run by me, she showed me the living will that her lawyer had given her, which is a very standard form in the state of Maryland, and it basically says, in this situation, do one of these three things, and you would check the box, and then in this situation, one of these three things, and in this third situation, one of these three things. And those three things are the same in each of the situations, but you're checking a box first. So the first situation is, you know, if I am, like, on my way out, you know, nothing's stopping this, I'm like about to die, boom, boom, boom. If I'm in a persistent vegetative state, boom, boom, boom. If I'm, you know, less than that, so if I'm injured or ill, but, you know, there's a chance of recovery, and boom, boom, boom. And those three for each of them had a lot to do with this artificial nutrition hydration, the ANH. Those three situations, the three options for each that you would pick was basically do everything that you possibly can, which is one extreme, which we call the vitalistic extreme. Just do everything you possibly can, every kind of, not just food and water, but every possible medical intervention you can to save my life. That was the first option you could check. The second option was just artificial nutrition and hydration, and then the last option was do nothing. And the do nothing is the other extreme, which we call the euthanistic kind of extreme. So we want to avoid both of those extremes of do everything or do nothing. But we also want to understand that even when it comes to artificial nutrition and hydration, that there are certain circumstances in which the Catholic Church says it's okay to forego those. And again, this is one of those things that, especially again around the time of Terry Schiavo, a lot of people thought that that's what the Catholic Church taught, that like you just always had to keep that person connected to the to the IV or the PEG tube, and again, generally, food and water are what we call ordinary or proportionate means. But what happens when your body stops absorbing it? You know, what happens in those kinds of situations? I had a seminary professor, a very old guy who had been teaching at the seminary for years and years and years, and this is exactly what happened to him. And actually, his anniversary of death is in 2 days. In 2 days. It was a few years ago, the end of July, he passed. And this is exactly what happened to him. He got to the point where his body was no longer accepting even the PEG tube, the IV. His body wasn't absorbing it. And so you could keep pumping him full of an IV, but it was just, it was not working. It had gotten to the point where it had become extraordinary. Even basic food and water had become what we call extraordinary. And this is why it was good that he did not have something that said, always give me food and water, because, again, what happens when your body's no longer accepting it? So that's kind of a long tangent there, but that's why it's important to have that healthcare power of attorney, not just a document. But that's why it's also important to have good documents, too. And like I said, the other thing I'm going to give you before you leave here is a Catholic version of the living will. Because again, I gave you this example of the lady who came to me and she had shown me what her lawyer had given her, which was a standard form that the state of Maryland uses, you know, in each of these three situations. Do everything, do just A&H, or do nothing. And the next situation, everything, just A&H, nothing. So it doesn't really address the points that a Catholic would want to address. And so the Maryland Catholic Conference, it's basically the group of bishops from the state of Maryland. You've heard of the USCCB, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, but then each state also has a conference of the Catholic bishops in that state. And the Maryland Catholic Conference, because Maryland's actually covered by three different dioceses, we actually have a pretty good Catholic conference that comes up with some very helpful documents. And this is one of them. It's called the Catholic Declaration on Healthcare Decision Making, and it basically comes as an attachment to a much larger document, which I did not copy for you, but the much larger document, if you're interested, is called Compassion and Consolation. It's available on the Maryland Catholic Conference's website if you double-check that. But this is a Catholic living will. It avoids the traps of a very rigid kind of these three situations, do one of these three things, check, check, check. It avoids that by explaining exactly what the Church teaches. This is a very good summary right here. But the other good thing about this being done by the Maryland Catholic Conference is it's all in accord with what Maryland law says. They actually research Maryland law in terms of what's required, what has to be done, even down to how many people need to sign this or whatever. So the nice thing about this that I'm going to give you is, in theory, I mean, it has signature blocks and everything. You could just fill this out, sign this yourself, and file it, and it would have the force of law, which is nice because it's actually, like I said, the Catholic living will. But some of the things we want to avoid that the Church teaches when it comes to end-of-life issues is we want to always avoid, number one, the standard kind of procedure-specific things. We want patient-specific things. We want to be able to take into account, again, those three sources of morality: action, intention, and circumstance. The other thing is something that people don't think about enough is we want to make sure that we are not deprived of our consciousness before we're able to receive something like the sacraments, before we're able to make our final goodbyes to family and friends. Now, obviously, it's one thing, like, if you are already unconscious and there's nothing they can do to bring you back to consciousness. But again, if you get one of these very rigid living wills from your lawyer and you check a box that says, do everything possible to keep me out of pain, well, that might include giving you like a real high dose of some kind of pain med that's going to knock you out, and maybe you'll wake up eventually, maybe you won't. But the problem then is, sure, you're not in any pain, but now you're also not in the position to say your final goodbyes or to confess one last time or anything else. And let me give you another very real situation. Just a few weeks ago, actually just 2 weeks ago, I was called to the hospital during lunch. It was the middle of the day. It was not like 3 a.m. at night. And even then, I'm more than happy to go. But this just kind of it makes it all the more weird to understand. But there was a person I got called, and I kind of yelled at the operator. I probably shouldn't have because it wasn't her fault. But she called me and said, "You need to come to the hospital right away. There's someone." Family's requested a priest, but the person's already passed. I said, "Why didn't you call me sooner? Like, the person's already dead?" So I still went right away. And then I got there, and my thought was, you know, I can understand if this were, like, 3 in the morning. Well, I can't really understand, but I could understand better if it was 3 in the morning and the family thinks, well, grandma's on her way out, you know, let's not bother the priest, it's the middle of the night, maybe you can just come in the morning and say some prayer. But even then, I mean, I can kind of understand that, but I would prefer to be bothered at 3 in the morning to come and give the last sacraments. But this was in the middle of the day, and what they did not think to do was, let's keep her alive at least long enough for the priest to get here to give her absolution and the apostolic pardon and the anointing, and send her on her way. The doctor, when I got there, met me and said, "Oh well, they had a DNR order, do not resuscitate," and which under certain circumstances can be okay if a resuscitation would be extraordinary means of keeping life alive. And we're going to get a little bit more into that in a minute. But my thinking was, but they took her off a ventilator, and they knew she was going to go. And I'm thinking, why didn't you, like, call me earlier? Why didn't you at least wait? And you know what? She might have been in a bit of pain for a little bit longer until I got there, but I think she probably would have liked that, to at least be sure that, like, before she goes, she knows that she's clean, ready to go. And so I did everything conditionally, but, you know, I mean, she was cold. Her head was cold. And so I'm thinking, maybe the soul's still here, maybe it's not, but if it is, you know, I absolve you, I pardon you, I anoint you, everything else. But it was just, it was kind of sad, because I thought, why didn't you do this sooner, you know? And that's something that one of these days at the pulpit I'm going to say something about, because it's not the first time this happened either. And it's like, why don't you think to call the priest before the person dies, you know? Again, it's one thing, like, if they get hit by a bus and they're dead before they get to the hospital, fine. But, like, if they're on their way out and you pulled the ventilator and whatever, why wouldn't you call sooner? But anyways, that's my own little, my rant is over on that. So we don't want to deprive consciousness before we have an opportunity to do those kinds of things. And again, some of these very rigid-looking living wills say something like, well, just give me everything. Well, you give them everything and you might knock them out, and then you don't have a chance to not just receive the sacraments, but to say goodbye to people and that kind of thing. The other thing is, sometimes with these documents, we don't focus enough on hastening one's death. We can never do anything directly to hasten one's death. It's fine if you're, this is where the doctrine of double effects kicks in, just another situation off the cuff here, if you're asking for a certain medication because you're in so much pain, and you know that with this medication, you know, you might not live as long because it, you know, whatever, but it's going to greatly reduce your pain. Your intention is not to hasten the death. The intention is simply to relieve the pain, and the action itself is good because it's a high dose of whatever, and that's fine. But that the intention there is not to hasten one's death. We need to make sure that we're not doing anything to hasten our death. And then finally, when we talk about useful and futile, beneficial and futile, a Catholic has no obligation to do that which is futile. The Catholic has no obligation to accept extraordinary means, disproportionate, extraordinary, futile, unuseful, whatever the word you want to use, means of preserving life, right? But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're not again hastening death. And then the next point is when we talk about something, a specific intervention being useful or not, because that's another category that we use in Catholic theology that a lot of these kind of documents don't have, is we talk about a specific intervention being useful or futile. And we say, well, if it's futile, it can be in good conscience refused. If it's not going to do anything, you know, even if it is artificial food and water, if it's not being absorbed, it can be refused in good conscience. But then, even if it is useful, then the question becomes, is it burdensome? And at a certain point, even those things which are useful can be refused at the point that they become burdensome. And that burden can even mean something like cost prohibitive. It becomes too burdensome on the person's body. It might be useful, but it might put the person in more pain than it's worth. You know, the person's on their way out and they're going to die soon, and it's a matter of, well, they can die in one day or they can die in 3 days. We can give them this to make them live 3 days longer, but, you know, at what point does it become burdensome, right? So these kinds of categories we use that they're generally foreign to most people. So I'll just wrap up with that. That's what we want to avoid when it comes to end-of-life issues. When it comes to, obviously, we can't do that which its action is evil in and of itself. We can't do that which is direct killing. But we also need to be careful about the intention and circumstances as well. Like I said, we can't have the intention of hastening death. But we're also not obliged to accept every possible medical intervention that there is. Like I said, in situations where it becomes futile, you don't have a moral obligation to accept or ask for those kinds of interventions when they're futile. And even when they're useful, once they become burdensome, you have no moral obligation to accept or ask for those interventions. So, questions?